children and other primitives. Indeed, the imposition of your model becomes quite questionable when I view this idea you have of language, especially where it is connected to the development of self-consciousness. Here it becomes clear that you view language as a system of efficiency. In your book, The Unended Quest, you give three of Bueller's functions of language: the expressive function, the signal or release function, and, on a higher level, the descriptive function. The two lower functions are supposedly common to human and animal languages and were always present, while the third function is characteristic for human language alone and sometime, as an exclamation, absent even from that. There's something remarkable about your conclusion from the presence of the two first functions, that is, like you say, it confirmed my view of the emptiness of the theory that art is self-expression. It led me later to the conclusion that the theory that art was communication, that is, release, was equally empty, since the two functions were trivially present in all language, even in animal languages. There is still a higher function of language to be found, which you have called the argumentative function, and which you regard as the basis of all critical thought. In these views, I sense a strong notion of hierarchy. There are lower levels, which are trivial, and higher levels, which are what? More real? On the discovery of this real world, you write, I became convinced that if we want to argue about it, we cannot start from our sense experiences, or even our feelings, as Gompert's theory demanded, without falling into the trap of psychologism, idealism, positivism, phenomenalism, even solipsism, all views which I refuse to take serious. I cannot but conclude from this that you would like to see us refute the reality of our own bodily experiences for the sake of argumentation. I am afraid that the trap in your work is exactly the one you try to prevent. It breeds the idea that whatever you do, do not believe your senses. Instead of facing the problem of subjectivity, you go around it by arguing the senses into oblivion. This is exactly what psychoanalysis has been doing over the last century, arguing that it is not the feelings of the individual which are true, but the linguistic operations we impose upon those feelings. As a mere matter of hierarchy, which you have established through the functions of language, you maintain the supreme power lies with the interpreter. Even if this power is temporal or hypothetical, it is highly undemocratic. By concluding that there is no induction unless by refutation or falsification, this indeed suggests that language can be an external entity of representation. Indeed, a Darwinian view of science, as it may be described, as a selection by the environment, meaning that only the fittest theories would survive. And this in itself begs even or demands the question, what is fitting? Indeed, selection by the external world. I would not want to put my cards on that type of selection. Such an experiment is even more dangerous than any form of historicism you have ever mentioned. Stigmatized as inferior, both humans and animals can quite easily be eliminated as falsified theories. You are opposing the idea of a prophetic future, but the point is that your hierarchical classifications in language entail a causal chain in time, which is evolutionistic. It is this hierarchical evolutionism that constructs the future of science as more rational, as more real, as more objective, indeed, the biggest myth of modern science. Your theory of language becomes even more questionable when you apply it to selves and to the development of children. For instance, when you compare the character of dreams to the level of consciousness of a baby. There can be little doubt that dreaming is conscious, but on a low level of consciousness. It is a far cry from a dream to a critical evaluation and revision of a difficult argument. Similarly, a newborn child has clearly a low level of consciousness. It probably takes years and acquiring of language and perhaps even critical thinking before the full consciousness of self is achieved. Beside your psychoanalytic classification of the dream, a classification that you yourself stated to be false, I really believe that you overstate your capacity to observe here, and all for the sake of not wanting and not allowing something as an internal world to exist or even to be present at birth. The entire idea of character, maybe because you dislike the idea of a soul or an origin that escapes your model, has disappeared here into an evolutionistic approach for which even Darwin would have turned around in his grave. A little later you state, "Is a newborn baby a self? Yes and no. It feels, it is capable of feeling pain and pleasure, but it is not yet a person in the sense of Kant. Thus, a baby is a body, a developing human body, before it becomes a person, a unity of body and mind." Now, I can find some sympathy for the fact that if, like you claim behaviorists do, language would be viewed solely as expression and communication, the result would be fatal. Quite right, we would not be able to make differences between propaganda, verbal intimidation, and rational argument. But, my dear Sir Carl, seeing what you write down about children as incomplete without speech, are you not exactly saying that language is verbal intimidation towards those who do not possess it? For in which way can this ever be falsified if the child cannot speak its mind to react on your prejudice about the judgmental capacity of children? And inasfar you apply a theory of interaction, do you not forget that by eliminating any kind of body experience, you also eliminate the possibility to trace that terrorizing operations onto that body back to its roots, its source, and last but not least, its justification of power? It is a small step from your view of children to saying that some selves are more self than others, which is exactly what you do when you proclaim that. It seems that children and perhaps most primitive people live through an animistic and hylozoistic stage in which they are inclined to assume the physical body that is inanimate, that is a person, until this theory is refuted by the passivity of the thing. So Carl, did you ever realize that refutation in this sense can also mean that the child is refuted its individual perception? And if a child is refuted through the falsification from an external world, does that mean that it is not a person? And if a child is violently oppressed into passivity, does this not imply a refutation of individuality? Do you really believe that a child which develops through refutation caused by an external world as a result of his experience will not wonder whether his experience might be his own? It is not, if at all, refutation that leads to existence, my friend. If so, those of us living in the worst of social conditions would be the happiest people on earth. The problems where refutation is concerned are amounting when you talk about the development of self. There is no self without a theoretical orientation, both in some primitive space or some primitive time. Here too, you keep stressing that children are born with expectations or theoretical assumptions, which are then refuted by an external world wherein lies their interactive experiments. You make wild guesses about children's developments by stating, "A human child growing up in social isolation will fail to attain full consciousness of self." It reminds me of an astrologer who once told me that people unaware of their disposition among the stars will miss their purpose in life. Who is the one that judges whether something is full consciousness of self in the first place? I would rather state that we are born with selves, but that most of our lives we try to retain that origin as becoming ourselves once more. The view you show here is, in all honesty, a constructivistic notion that you criticize so heavily in the work of others, especially Marx. You seem to forget here that there are all kinds of mechanisms in society that prevent democratic self-reliance from actually emerging. A newborn baby has indeed very little to say about itself. It nevertheless still exists, even if it cannot speak about it. When you are inclined to suggest, for instance, that a child tries actively to draw attention to himself, it is part of a learning process, don't you realize that the poor thing might be hungry or in need of affection or even thirsty, and that this drawing attention is a need rather than an expectation? And that this need, together with the needs of thousands of other hungry people on the face of this earth, renders it quite powerless as to what will be imposed? Being hungry, one cares little or nothing whether the knowledge and values of an open society are right or wrong, or open at all. The jubilee of language, which you create here as a system of interaction, also has another side, a system of oppression. That is, oppression under the conditions that you state to be self-consciousness. The child either fits within your expectations or remains an incomplete human being, notwithstanding the tremendous prejudice you transfer onto what you call primitive people. And why? For what? All for the sake of proving what? That scientific rationality is the most superior mode of thinking? And in order to reach that one aim, which brings individual bodies back into a mixture of biological disposition, external influence, and shaggy interaction in obtaining true knowledge? On the one hand, you say that it is impossible for a scientist to predict the outcome of a true experiment. And when you apply what you call an individual methodology, you point toward one case which could refute a former hypothesis. But on the other hand, you do not actually take that method seriously when it is most necessarily in dealing with the differentiated outcomes of individual human beings. Sir Carl, you are not responsible for the death of logical positivism, as you state in The Unended Quest. In fact, you reinvented it.